Good morning, everyone. I'll call the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices to order. Representative Lunan, have you had the opportunity to read through the minutes?
Actually, I have.
Okay, great. All right. The minutes have been moved. Discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor, approval of the minutes of March 6, 2018, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. The first bill on our agenda today is House File 2815.
Representative Dean. Hi, I'm looking at the minutes, and I believe I was here on this day, and my name's not on here. Have I been moved off the committee?
No, you have not. Okay, we will fix them and adopt them next week. Re-adopt them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For bringing our attention to that. Representative Green, you have House File 2815. The motion is that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy. I understand that there is an amendment, and I know that you have several versions of this bill out there, and so we're interested in what your story is that brought this about. And so with that, I will move House File 2815 and recommend that it be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is the amendment yours?
Pardon me?
Is the amendment yours?
Your amendment?
Okay. So we will, I can move the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted and the bill is in the shape that the author wishes. Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 2815 is a bill that I started on over a year ago, looking into different aspects. There was a problem brought to me by a person with disabilities whose dog had been attacked by a fake service dog. And because of the injuries, the dog had to be put down.
Ugh.
And so she was pretty persistent, but I've tried to do my homework, tried to check into a lot of the ADA laws from the federal government, and tried to draft a bill that could put some pretty stiff penalties on people that misrepresent their dogs, and because it's becoming a real problem. And this is what we came up with. This is the first draft of this bill, and yes, there are other versions of it because we were getting some pushback. It's an important subject to me. I want to get it through. So I've been working with other people, but this is my first bill. It's the one that I like, and I'm not willing to let it die. So that's why we're at your committee.
Okay.
So the bill is pretty simple. It does put into the statute the questions that are that a peace officer can ask. And by law, through the ADA, they can only ask two questions, but most of the time people won't even ask that because they're afraid of being sued. But the questions are, is the animal required due to a disability, and what are the tasks that it's trained to perform? And there's a lot of things that can be done if the dog is misbehaving, whether it's a service animal or not. That can be asked to leave. I do have testifiers that could testify more to those laws and the questions that can be asked that will do a way better job than I do. But the bill is pretty simple. If you've read it, it establishes a crime. It imposes a fine, and it also allows for community service for those who can't afford the fine.
Thank you. Do you have Representative O'Neill?
Just really quick, Madam Chair. I was just curious why you drafted it to the human rights statute.
Representative Green.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I will tell you honestly, I went to research with this bill. I told them what I wanted. I said, these are the things that I want. Can you put them into a bill for me? And they did, and this is where it ended up. So.
Madam Chair. Representative O'Neill.
Do you know the implications of the human rights statute?
Of this?
Representative Green?
I think I would rather have testifiers answer that, Representative.
Okay, very good. If you want to call your first testifier, is that Marilyn Schmidt? Marilyn Schmidt from Park Rapids? Welcome to the committee. Did you come this morning? Did you leave your...
Oh,
good. I was going to say, man, you really got up early. All right.
I'm way too old to do that in the morning.
Yeah.
No, we spent the night last night.
Okay, good. If you want to introduce yourself for your tape, then you can go ahead with your testimony.
I'm Marilyn Schmidt. I'm from Park Rapids. I'm 80 years old. I am almost 60 years into being a diabetic. I don't know if any of you are service dog people or if you've been around people who have service dogs, but the dogs are exceedingly important to us. 8 months ago yesterday, I lost my first service dog. On November 22nd in 2016, he woke my husband up during the night because I was in a near-fatal diabetic coma. If I hadn't had the dog, I wouldn't be here. A dog that is trained is so important, and you don't understand that it takes a year and a half to 2 years to train a dog. I'm on my second service dog. I have most of him here because he's a white lab. He's on my legs. I didn't realize how he would shed on my cords, but he is here. Anyway, I'm only 3 months into training him. I didn't feel that he was up to laying here quietly in front of you. Give me a couple more months and he'd be in great shape. My first dog was 123 pounds. He was a Rottweiler Bernese Mountain Dog. Totally gentle. Any service dog cannot be aggressive in any way, shape, or form. He was attacked 3 times by 2 dogs at Costco, by a black lab at Olive Garden, and by a German Shepherd at a grocery store in Park Rapids. And he would just look at him like, what are you doing? Because he knew how to act. The people that bring their dogs in, their pets, I call them, they bring them in, they're not trained. They don't know how to act. I've had people from Costco asking me repeatedly to have something done because their lawyers have told them that they cannot stop a dog from coming in if the people say it's a service dog. I've had people from hotels, restaurants, a lot of restaurants, and all kinds of stores, because they deal with a service dog and they know what a real service dog is. And the other dogs, something has to be done to stop it. And I've been talking to Steve on the phone quite a bit about this. It was nice to meet him in person, by the way. Any other questions you have of me?
Remember questions. Doesn't look like it. Thank you so much for being here.
No problem. Can you tell that it's worth coming down? That's how important this is to me.
Sure.
My husband said, you're serious, you want to drive down. I said, hey, for this, I will drive down.
Great. Well, we appreciate you making the trip.
No problem.
Thank you so much.
No problem,
Ms. Smith.
Steve. Anything I can do.
Thank you. The next testifier is Alan Peters. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Alan Peters. I'm the executive director and founder of CANDU Canines. We train assistance dogs for people with disabilities. We've trained more than 600 dogs for people here in Minnesota and surrounding states across the years. So we have a lot of experience with people who are going through this exact story, but we hear it multiple times. People who have a dog that's highly valued, it costs our organization more than $25,000 to train each dog. Guide dogs for people who are blind can be upwards of $100,000. Extremely valuable animals that are being attacked and accosted in public places by people who think that they're doing something cute. They think, oh, you know, we've seen other assistance dogs do this, so I'll buy a cape for a couple of dollars online, pretend my dog is an assistance dog, and take it with me everywhere I go. Take it for a ride on an airplane, on a bus, not thinking about the impact that they're having on the lives of people with disabilities. It is absolutely critical that, our clients be able to take their dogs everywhere they go. We have clients, just like the lady you spoke to, who has diabetes, who has that, should have that dog with her every minute of every day to alert her. You're going to hear testimony from another one of our clients who has a seizure disorder. Her seizures happen when they happen, and she needs that dog to help her, to warn her, to take care of her, and to have to worry about what's going to happen in a public place because somebody's trying to get a special favor, a special privilege, is a terrible thing. Every time these dogs go into a public place and misbehave, they walk in, they pee on the carpet, or they poop, or they bark, or they misbehave, the public sees them, and they don't know the difference between our trained dogs and the dogs that are being impostered. Consequently, they're scratching their head, and they're saying, look at these assistance dogs. They're not being well-trained. They shouldn't be allowed in public. And before you know it, the laws will change. The ADA went into effect 30-some years ago, I believe it is, and it took a long time to make that happen. It can get undone by imposters. So we feel it's really important. We're very grateful to the representative for bringing this forward. I actually brought different legislation forward with Ann Rest in the Senate, but there are multiple reasons for that. It's coming from all different sources across the state. There's at least 20 states that have already passed legislation like this, and we think it's critical that it happen here.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Howe, and then Representative Lunan. Oh, you're not you? Okay. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is why hasn't this been done federally? I'm concerned with people coming from out of state into this state with a service dog or other dogs, comfort dogs, whatever you want to call them, and not be realizing what the law is. I would think this would be a change in the ADA law, and where is the efforts there? Because I firmly believe if you're going to do it, it should be a federally done thing. And is there any efforts going on to do that at the ADA level?
I am with Mr. you completely, Peters. But to my knowledge, it's not. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. To my knowledge, it's not happening on the federal level. It's starting out of the states because that's all we've got to work with at this point. That's often the way assistance dog law happened in the past. In fact, Minnesota was the first place to allow hearing dogs access, like guide dogs for the blind, back when Wendy Anderson was the governor. That had to start somewhere, and it started on the state level, and eventually that spilled over into the ADA. And I think that's what's going to happen here is I believe states will be passing laws, and we'll have a bunch of different laws, and hopefully then the federal government will do that. It doesn't seem that this is a priority there.
Representative Howe?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm a little frustrated with that because I deal with code enforcement, and that ADA law seems to be one of my things that changes most frequently for me, so I'm a little concerned that the effort isn't there, and that's, to me, to have a more uniform posture rather than state by state and making it difficult for folks coming in from to resort type things.
Madam Chair, I would add that having a state law is also important, as well as having the federal law. We should have a federal law that covers everybody so that regardless of which state you're in, mm-hmm. it's consistent. However, the federal law is governed by the Department of Justice, and to get any kind of satisfaction, if somebody's violated that law, you have to start a lawsuit. And it can take years to get anything to happen. When you have legislation on our books here, you can call a police officer or you can call the county attorney and take action to interrupt something that's improper that's going on. So having both seems to be important. There was a question about the placement of the law, too, with the human rights. Is that? Would you still like an answer on that?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. I wasn't understanding why it was placed in the Human Rights Act and what was the logic behind that and what was the implications that's different from just being in the criminal statute.
Mr. Peters.
We did not do this with Senator Rest, but when I saw it in Representative Green's bill, I thought this was genius because this is where most of assistance dog law here in Minnesota resides. So this is where police officers will go. This is what they're used to doing, is looking at 363. So adding it on to 363 just made common sense to me. I don't know about legal sense. I don't know about the criminal laws, but this is where we in the industry go and where our clients go to demonstrate that they have an assistance dog and what the rules are.
Representative O'Neill, follow-up. Thank you. Any other member questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here and for your testimony. Next testifier is Terry Craik and service dog Brody.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Go ahead, state your name and proceed with your testimony if you
would. Sure. My name is Terry Craik. I come from a law enforcement background, and I received Brody 8 years ago, but I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 years an influx of what I call fakers, because the internet is so easily accessible. Someone can get online, order a fake Kate, even order an ID, which the ADA does not require. I teach classes to the Minneapolis police officers. We've done all their in-service, all 900 officers, based on the ADA guidelines. This representative's bill is really adding to 363, which would just be a little bit more of a definition that we would need to give to the police, because the only way to really tell the difference between a fake service dog and a real service dog, according to ADA, is the behavior of the animal. If the animal is not under control, if the animal defecates in public, those are grounds to have the animal removed. The person can come back and get the goods, but the dog is no longer allowed back in there. And so Brody's been bitten by a fake service dog at Target, and I kicked the heck out of that dog because I'm very, very protective of mine. And I finally got the lady to admit that it was an emotional assistance dog. And emotional assistance dogs are typically used for a psychiatrist to write a prescription saying that that person needs an emotional assistance dog to live in their dwelling where they don't allow pets, but they are not allowed public access. Therapy dogs are allowed access at certain hospitals or certain schools for the kids to read to them, but they're not allowed public access. So when we run into these fakers, it really, really makes it hard for me coming in after that dog to represent that this is, in fact, a service animal. What I tell the police is if the demeanor of the dog is not like Brody's, if they're lunging, if they're barking, if, God forbid, they've bitten someone, they need to be out of there. This bill gives teeth to that so that the police officers, when they get there, they have something to write.
Thank you, Ms. Craig. Are there any questions for this testifier? Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate both you and Brody being here today. Next testifier is Ron Elwood. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and with me today are two attorneys, staff attorneys from our Legal Aid's Disability Law Center, Chad Wilson and Justin Page. And thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And the Minnesota, I think you're all familiar with Legal Aid. We've been around for 100 years in Minnesota, and I've been here for 20, and our group has been here for 40. The Minnesota Disability Law Center, which you may not know, is part of Legal Aid and has been around for 42 years. 1975, Congress established a nationwide system, a protection and advocacy system for persons with disabilities, and has named designates in every state a single agency to perform that service and that that advocacy. And we are extremely proud to have been the designee for the last 42 years. So, first of all, I want to thank Representative Green for bringing this bill forward. It's clearly an important bill. I agree that this is extremely important. And also just want to thank the Grocers Association for listening to us and talking with us and working with us. Of course, we support the intent of this bill. We must condemn, address, and prevent the intentional misrepresentation of non-service animals as service animals. This kind of an act does a disservice to our clients, all Minnesotans with disabilities, and to the trained and dedicated dogs who provide assistance. But we would like to just offer some technical suggestions to strengthen and improve the bill. First, we would respectfully suggest that rather than place this in the Human Rights Act, I think it more properly belongs in our animal law. We would create a new section, 346.45, which would make it unlawful to intentionally misrepresent an animal as a service animal in any public accommodation. Second, on lines 2.3 to 2.4, the definition of the service animal as defined by the Federal Americans with Disability Act, we believe is insufficiently specific, and in fact invites the problems of the miniature horses and the, you know, service cockatoos and all that kind of thing. And we would recommend actually amending this definition to cross-reference the definition of service animal in the Americans with Disabilities Act regulations, 28 CFR 36.104. Why that's critically important is because that definition expressly limits the type of animal that's covered to a dog. So anything else is not a service animal by definition under the ADA, under the CFR. So we think that would be a strengthening of the bill. Very critically important, we also strongly recommend striking knowingly on line 1.20 and striking the definition of knowingly on lines 2.15 through 2.17. And replacing that in line one, on line 1.20 with intentionally. Legally, that's a really important distinction. Knowing implies knowledge but not intent. And if we're going to create a crime or even use any other crimes, clearly the appropriate state of mind is necessary to satisfy the most important element of a criminal act, where an act is performed to create the desired result. So we really believe that intentionality is the key here. On lines 2.9 through 2.12, rather than allowing a peace officer to ask the two questions, we would respectfully suggest that we have a supervisor at the store be required to ask those two questions before excluding an animal and a person with a disability. And that way, I think we could avoid a lot of unintentional consequences and problems of accusing somebody who may actually be legitimately with a service dog and exclude them. And finally, we would add the following provisions to strengthen the bill and add more protections for both businesses and for persons with disabilities and protect excluding a person with a legitimate service dog. First, we would define what misrepresentation means. And we would suggest to you that it should say it's misrepresenting an animal as a service animal if the animal is not a service dog or the person does not have a disability. So we'd be pretty clear, we'd tighten that up so we know exactly what misrepresentation means. Also, we appreciate the intention to protect service animals in training, which is really critical, but there is no definition of it, and we would provide one and suggest that so that we don't wind up with excluding somebody inappropriately. He was actually training a service animal. Third, we would allow a store owner to exclude any animal that is not a dog. Clearly, because as we said before, under the federal definition in 28 CFR 36.104, a service animal is only a dog. Next, we would clarify and mirror the federal law to put in the bill that any animal, whether or not a service animal, which is out of control or not housebroken, can be asked to leave, and that is the law as it is. Next, we would clarify that that a store owner may not ask for certification. This is one of the big confusions. You know, logic would tell you that there should be some sort of paper, right, that says this is a legitimate service dog. The reality is it is not, because a person can train his or her own service dog, and under the federal law, you cannot. Asking for clarification is not required. So we would make sure, and Representative Howe, if the feds change that, then we could mirror that. But I think we should mirror federal law and make it clear that people can't ask for a certification because it's not required. Also, we would cross-reference the existing rights under the Minnesota Human Rights Act 363A.33, for persons with legitimate service animals to take legal action if they are improperly and illegally excluded. It's sort of the balancing of the bill here to make sure that if somebody does exclude a person improperly, that we can make it clear that they have the rights, existing rights. We're not creating new rights. We're just cross-referencing it to make it crystal clear, very tight. And then finally, rather than creating a new misdemeanor crime, we would suggest invoking the existing misdemeanor crime of trespass. We worry about excluding folks who do not present with obvious disabilities. We worry about people, our clients with mental illness, who may really have no idea what a service animal is, what an emotional support animal is, and we would worry that there would be some confrontations would be problematic for them, their health, and well-being. So my understanding is that in the 20 states that have done this, this crime has never been enforced. I know there's a newspaper article that was circular that I had gotten, and you know, the article says because there is no certification or official registry, there's really no way to verify whether a dog has undergone training or is a legitimate service animal. And consequently, apparently the states that have done this have never prosecuted anyone. So it strikes me that if we can exclude somebody for a trespass, and you can say, if you don't get out of here, we're going to call the police, and if you come back, we're going to call the police, that accomplishes the goal, which what I think is to exclude folks who are not legitimately there. I've heard the concern that, well, then they can go from one store to the other, but I would suspect that if there's no enforcement, then A, it doesn't matter, and B, if you are threatened with police action, I'm not sure people would be going from one store to the other, but at least for that one store, you would get the person out. So, with that, we have our folks here to answer any questions. Thank you for indulging me with all this blather, and we're here to answer questions. Thank you very much. We look forward to working with the authors and the proponents to get this bill in the shape it needs.
Thank you, and those are, I think, really good suggestions, and we want to. This is a really serious matter, and so to the extent that we can make the bill the best that it can be, we need to do that. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Green, for bringing the bill forward. I really appreciate all of the background, and I think some of the ideas sound good. I have not delved into all of the things you suggested. But one question I had was when you mentioned knowingly and intentionally, when I listened and actually read the letter you sent us too about the distinctions, to me, I don't know that it really would matter that much, because if you know you're misrepresenting an animal, whether you're intentionally getting the benefits or not, you're lying. And that to me says, okay, you're doing something wrong. There should be a fine. I mean, it would be And even, honestly, even if you're not lying, say, you know, I'm driving my car, I know the speed limit is 30, but I become absent-minded and I start speeding, I'm not going to be able to get out of a speeding ticket by saying, oh, I knew I just got absent-minded. Any response to that or any thoughts on that?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Whalen, I mean, logic says it's kind of the same thing, and it is in some ways. But intentional incorporates knowingly, whereas knowingly does not incorporate intent. And in our criminal laws, the single most critical element to demonstrate that a crime has been committed is intent. And that word, and we're just trying to mirror what existing criminal law is. And we also, you know, I think your example is perfect. You know, you're committing an infraction by speeding, but you're not committing a crime. And if you're going to be prosecuted for a crime, there has to be not only that you know it, but you actually intend the result that it is. So it's really trying to just mirror existing and long-standing criminal elements.
Representative Whalen.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that response. So then would you be, what would your response be? So, for example, I didn't intentionally speed. I can still get a ticket. Okay, I didn't mean to, and honestly, I still don't know how this would work, because to me, if you know you're misrepresenting an animal, you're lying, and that says to me there should be some sort of fine applicable. So is there middle ground? Do you see that you could still basically punish someone for lying?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Whalen, your example of speeding is not a misdemeanor crime. This would be a misdemeanor crime. So if we're talking about that level, then I think we need to make sure that it's clear that there was an intentional thing to do it. You know, you get a ticket and you pay a fine, but you're not subject to a misdemeanor. And that's really, I think, the salient point.
Representative Whalen.
Just final follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Completely understand what you're saying. I'm just wondering if you personally, or, you know, your group would say, make it less than a misdemeanor, but still allow some sort of penalty. You know, not so it wouldn't be a misdemeanor, but, you know, we're going to still give you a ticket similar to. Would that be acceptable to you?
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Representative Whalen, Representative Green's other bill actually does have a tiered structure where at first it's a petty misdemeanor, which is really more like a fine, and then if you do it the second time, it would be a crime. You know, I think the intent of the author and the proponents and everybody else is to send a really clear signal that this is wrong. And I think there's a little squishiness about sort of not being strong enough, and I think there's an interest in making it a misdemeanor, which is why we suggest that if we use the trespass law instead, I think we smooth out some of the potential unintended consequences while creating a similar level crime that sends a signal, and you can put it up on the sign. This is a crime. This is a misdemeanor. If you do this, and I think fulfill the purpose that we all want here. So that's what I would say to that.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Green for all of your work on this bill. A year's worth of work, and just so pleased, and to all the testifiers, the great ideas and suggestions that have come forward, and especially to the testifier who drove well over an hour to get here, and we really appreciate hearing from you this morning. So, Representative Green, this may be a simple bill. I see it's only just two pages, but obviously really significant ramifications, and I'm so grateful we're talking about this. I've heard from a number of my constituents on this bill encouraging my support for it. I know of other constituents who have been longtime trainers of service dogs, and over the years have expressed concern to me about a number of the issues that they've experienced with their dogs, similar to the ones we heard from those who testified. So the concern about the biting and misbehavior and whatnot, I mean, this is definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. In fact, I had I had an experience recently. I toured one of the many fabulous grocery stores in my district. It was a Kowalski's, and we were talking about this issue, and it came to mind as I looked at all of the incredible fresh food and, you know, all of that right there, and thought about, you know, animals that would be coming into the store, and that's for health codes and standards. I mean, that's clearly a violation, not acceptable. I reflected on my experience as the general manager for a Dayton store right downtown St. Paul here for many years. You know, I had two restaurants and a deli, and, you know, had we had any of those issues then, I would have been accountable to, you know, all of the rules and regulations surrounding food service. And, you know, this is definitely an issue that needs to be addressed. I asked, and I don't see this in your bill, and I understand it sounds like you maybe have another bill, so looking forward to talking to you offline about this. But I'm thinking that putting myself in the shoes of the general manager that, you know, who's focused on delivering exceptional customer service, which Kowalski's does, approaching somebody and challenging the status of their dog and whether it belongs there or not. I mean, that's a precarious situation for someone in that capacity. So I think a sign on the exterior of the building with the law or the law is not enough. I mean, that's important. But if I were in those shoes as the general manager or the supervisor on duty, I would definitely want some sort of a handout that would have everything that I was about to say on it. You know, those situations can become emotional and can escalate to a situation that others would perceive would be a customer conflict, and really it would just be incumbent upon that general manager or supervisor to be doing their due diligence and having that important conversation with their customer who may be violating the law. So I would just encourage that, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Elwood, not Representative, Mr. Elwood.
Thanks for the promotion. Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, you know, that was one of the things, that's why I think the concept of trespass makes sense, because in the landlord-tenant context when we use these, that's exactly what happens. The landlord has a little card and can present it. They trespass somebody. It tells them what the law is, and they said, if you, here's the deal on Minnesota statutes, blah, 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 you can't be on this property, you're unauthorized. If you come back again, we're calling the cops. And so I think, you know, we're sort of thinking on the same page, because that we wanted to apply that same concept, and that would fulfill what you're just saying. So just to add on to that.
Representative Powell. Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back to the same question I had at the beginning, which is the distinction if we put it in the Human Rights Act versus, you had said, the animal chapter or maybe even the criminal statute. Can you just give us a little bit more meat as to why not in the Human Rights Act?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, I think if we're creating a crime, it just doesn't belong in the Human Rights Act. That's just it's sort of an apples and oranges thing. You know, I think if we put it in the animal law, we don't have to make it a crime in there, but we can make it illegal. We have that many laws across the books that it's unlawful to do this, that, or the other thing, but it's not a crime. So it fits better there. And it's also really about animal control, this bill. And then, again, you know, our suggestion is to use an existing crime, and so they dovetail together. That's our approach. That would be, yeah.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill in a different form is currently on the table in the Public Safety Committee. Some amendments have been adopted in the Senate. I think it would be great if the folks could get together and decide what is the best place for this to be. I think everyone is for addressing this issue, and the question is, where's the best place to put it so that the folks who have to use it can effectively use it? And so I would encourage us to pass this on to the Public Safety Committee so that all the bills are there and the author get together with Legal Aid and the stakeholders and see if you can't craft something that really works for folks, because I think we're all for addressing the issue.
Yeah, amen, sister. So, yeah, I think there are issues probably with putting this in the human rights statute, and I think that Representative Green is dedicated to getting something done about this. Obviously, he's very passionate about it, and so I think to the extent that we can do what Representative Hillstrom just said and have this bill move on to public safety and all the parties come together and really get a good bill with teeth to it in the appropriate place in statute, I think will be will make it much more enforceable as well. So any further questions? With that, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, I would like to renew my motion that House File 2815 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy, as amended, by the way. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Green.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, he just walked out. It's like it happens in 3 days.
No, not at all. Just didn't want to run you over.
Good morning, Representative Hamilton. How are you?
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good. Let's see. We have House File 2982 before us. Representative Howell moves House File 2982 before us, and I understand there is an amendment. Representative Lesh?
Oh, is that my amendment? Sure.
I believe so. The one with the artwork on it? Was that yours?
Oh, no, that was the old version, I'm sure. But there was an amendment that I know was submitted, I think, by the U, right? I mean, I'll offer it for consideration. I think that would be a cleanup. Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, there was another amendment that was offered.
Use your mic there, Representative Lesh.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yours is the A1. Is that correct, Representative Lesh?
I think that's correct, Madam Chair.
A1,
yes, I've got it. Yes, that is my amendment, Madam Chair.
All right.
But I honestly can't remember
which two sides were talking about this, and I can't remember if this was offered by the U or by the other folks. So maybe whoever wanted this could speak to it, and we could talk about it. I've been mulling over this for a while to try to figure out the right way to do this. So
all right.
Someone else could speak to it.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesh. You're right. I mean, there's a number of people trying to find workable language, if you will. And, Madam Chair, if it's okay, what I would like to do is take the testimony from the University of Minnesota and then the other testifiers as well, and then we can zero in if this language is indeed necessary, if that would be permissible.
All right. Is that okay with the amendment's author?
It is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Very good. Go ahead to your bill, Representative Hamilton.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. What we're wanting to accomplish here is that the data that's provided by individuals, specifically to agriculture, that would remain private. And what our fear is, if that data is not remaining private, that we won't have anybody participating in the research projects. And that would be very detrimental to everybody. The aggregate of the data that's collected and the research findings would remain public, and we want to be very, very clear on that. And so, Madam Chairman, at this time, I'd like to turn it over to our testifier.
Great. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Scott, members of the committee, I'm Brian Boer, and I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. I want to thank you all for listening to this legislation. I want to thank Representative Hamilton for sponsoring the legislation. We're asking that the language provided, your support for the language provided, strengthens data privacy and protection for farm data used for research purposes at the University of Minnesota. Because farm data is often private, we want to assure that it has the same protection as, for example, human health care data. In fact, we often call it HIPAA for farmers to protect their private information. This legislation would accomplish the goal by adding a direct statement of privacy and acceptable uses for farm data provided to the university. It's similar to the privacy of farm data already provided to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in existing law. Agriculture and food production is central to the thriving economy of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has, for more than 150 years, conducted research and education to develop and promote new innovations that improve agricultural productivity, food availability and security and safety, while preserving and protecting our natural resources and environment. New innovations in information and measurement technologies in the form of computers and sensing devices, such as high spectral imagery cameras, moisture tactile sensors, such as moisture sensing, robotics technologies have created an unprecedented potential for understanding agroecological interactions and improving research for public use. In order to fully realize this potential, the University of Minnesota is increasingly working with farmers, agribusinesses, and government agencies to capture and analyze the data and make results public for Minnesotans to learn and use in their daily lives. Our unique position as a trusted neutral party allows us to seamlessly link research potential from farm data to create public value by informing development and deployment of new technologies to improve profitability of farmers, the quality of policies affecting farmers, and healthy agroecologies. This potential is maximized when there is greater farmer, agribusiness, and government participation in sharing data with the University of Minnesota. Without participation of those data providers, none of this publicly available research is possible, to the detriment of farmers, consumers, and the environment, and Minnesotans. Therefore, we seek this classification of data privacy in agriculture to drive and protect that greater participation. Without this amendment, those who provide us data voluntarily may not have confidence that we can protect it and not identify them. This limits their participation and consequently reduces our ability to provide sound and complete research analysis to the public. To be clear, regardless of the data collected, only data that identifies the source will be held as private. As is the case today, data that is aggregated or de-identified and that cannot be linked to individuals will be publishable, and all analysis of the University of Minnesota's research will be open and accessible to the public, just as it always is under the Board of Regents' open research policy. In summary, the legislative changes proposed would assure all farm data is subject to the same level of protection as other private data, that the university as a neutral party can continue to work confidently with agricultural data across farmers, businesses, government agencies, and others without compromising data security and privacy, that the university, with its world-class capabilities in informatics and data analytics, will be able to effectively conduct research in agricultural practices, improving environmental outcomes, and incentivizing broad participation, and that we'll have the highest possible level of participation by data providers to improve the scientific quality of public results in this rapidly changing and diverse agricultural ecology of Minnesota. Chair Scott, again, I thank you for hearing this, and members of the committee, I thank you for your support of the university.
Thank you for being here this morning. Are there member questions? Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, thank you, Dean. Well, I tell you what, why don't we wait till – I'll wait till ask questions until we hear from everyone, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Sure. Let's see. Next testifier is Matt Ealing with Minkoji. And on deck is Chris Cohen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'd like to talk about the impact of the language in the bill in the first engrossment. I mean, we're certainly sympathetic to the aims, and we've talked to the university and to Representative Hamilton about how to achieve what they want to achieve in the way of protecting individual farmer data. We're just concerned that there may be unintended impacts from the language as written in the first engrossment, and we'd like to suggest an alternative. So as you know, data that is maintained, collected, created by government entities under Minnesota law is public by default. If you want to make it not public, you have to add a specific statutory site in Chapter 13. So walking through the first engrossment, You'll see here that the there's an existing statute regarding Department of Agriculture data that's being amended to add the University of Minnesota as well. And that existing statute says that there's very specific data collected by those entities or maintained by those entities that is not public, including names, addresses, telephone numbers, email addresses of study participants in these agricultural studies, and also location study sites, global positioning data as well in item number two there. There's a new section that's being added in number three, and this is where we have concerns because this gets away from specific identifying information and can be read more broadly because it says that data created, collected, or maintained by the university for inclusion essentially in an agricultural research database maintained by the or hosted by the university is also not public. So that gets away from the specific individual identifier data. Now, the university has said that they have concerns. The reason why they're bringing in the broader language here is because they can't predict what kind of identifying data will be submitted in the future by farmers to these programs. So we'd suggest that there's language that could address this that would read as follows. You could sub out number three, as it is in the first engrossment, and replace it with data that would identify study participants or cooperators and trade secret data related to study participants or cooperators. The benefit is that you're keeping the language narrowly tailored to the study participants. So data that would identify them wouldn't just be name. That would be, say, you have a photograph of the property that could be clearly identified as the property. That would be not public. So that's the kind of thing that first section gets to. The reference to trade secret data is a cross-reference to an existing section of law that has been on the books for over, just about four decades. So in the event that farmers had submitted proprietary business information to the university or to the Department of Agriculture, that would also be kept not public under the existing multi-point framework of the trade secret data in 1337. So that's our best way of addressing those kinds of issues, keeping it narrowly focused on the farmers. I'd be happy to take questions now or afterwards.
Thank you for your testimony. I think those are a good suggestion. When I was meeting with Representative Hamilton on this bill, my concern was that we make it as tight as possible to protect the identities and the mm-hmm. locations and so forth of all the farmers. So I appreciate your suggestions. Are there member questions? All right. See none. The next testifier is Chris Cohen. Thank you, Mr. Aileen. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliations, if any, for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Cowan. I'm a lobbyist. I work with the Pesticide Action Network and the Natural Resources Defense Council. And what we do, we're usually not in this committee, but what we're concerned with is protecting pollinators from pesticides and doing it in a way that works for farmers. I don't think there's anyone who disagrees with the intent of protecting individual data on farmers so that they can participate in these programs, and we're in that group too. But what is important is that we have access to the science. If you're in the Ag Committee, it's always important that policy and decisions are made based on good science. So we need access to that. And I share the same concerns as the previous testifier, Mr. Elling. If you look at paragraph that starts at 1.15, starting with number three, data collected and data created and collected, and going on from there. I'm not any sort of expert. You all know Chapter 13 way better than I do, but kind of from my layman's point of view, when I look at Chapter 13, I see 10 very specific definitions for data. And in this language, it just says data. That's the concern, because once it becomes non-public or private, then the University of Minnesota is going to be duty-bound by law to protect it. this seems to go way beyond protecting the data of individuals. It seems very open-ended to me. I respect the folks who are bringing this forward, but have great concerns about the scope of this. And I would also like to point out that reference has been made to what's being amended here in 13.643. There's several roadmaps here in the existing subdivisions, and including the subdivision that's being amended, where very specifically, I'll just outline a couple. And this all has to do with agricultural data. Department of Agricultural Data, Subdivision 1, loan and grant applicant data. Data on applicants, private and non-public. Farm advocate data. Data supplied by farmer clients, private data. And it spells it out very specifically, as I believe that it should. I hope the committee takes this to heart, and we support what Mr. Erling was outlining as language that seems appropriate and would protect everybody and would keep it very narrow as it should be. I've always enjoyed working with the author, Chair Hamilton, and I hope we can come to a resolution on this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this testifier? Thank you for sharing those good points. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh, we'll go back to your amendment.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton. So when I'm not particularly an ag person. I don't know a lot about this, but when I did read the language, so the bills that come through this committee, whether it's LPRs or whether it's, you know, all the data sets we create, we've grown paranoid at being too broad, because inevitably 3 or 4 years later something comes back which we didn't intend. So I tend to think that it's the intent of the committee to be very prescriptive about it, and that if, you know, a reason comes up later to expand the data set, that we do that. And so when I saw the language, and first of all, I want to thank the U, because the U was very proactive, J.D. Burton and the dean, in seeking me out, I know, earlier, and say, hey, here's what we want to do. Are you okay with this? And I honestly didn't have a good answer for him at the time, because I was like, well, I don't know. I got to look at it more. I got to digest it. And over the time since then, in speaking with some data practices people, I felt like it really was too broad. And so when I look at the proposed amendment A1, and again, I guess this was drafted under my name, Madam Chair. I'll believe you if you tell me it. That's fine. But, you know, even this amendment says or in there. On line 1.4, platform maintained or hosted by the University of Minnesota. That or indicates that any data collected by the University of Minnesota for agricultural purposes now becomes non-public. And I fear even the language as drafted here in my amendment is too broad, because that means everything that the U has that they collected, whether it should be private or not, because we all know what we're trying to protect here, right? You have farmers' financial records. You got, you know, maybe, I don't know, trade secrets or something, you know, that they're like, we don't want this disclosed. But anything casually observed by a person who is paid by the U or state government now is non-public. And as stated by someone else, I can't remember who it was.
Mr. Cohen.
Oh, yeah, it was Mr. Chris Cohen. Now it's $2,000 a pop for every violation if that leaks. Not to mention the obvious need to have things be public anyway that you know, shouldn't be private. So I feel like I would want to at least change that or to and in this amendment. Could I do an oral amendment, Madam Chair, on that?
I believe so.
And then I would offer it, but I would still want to work with you, Representative Hamilton, to, you know, make sure we're getting to what we want to do here successfully, because I think we all agree that's what we want to do. Would you be amenable to that and the amendment? And here's the other thing. You know, I don't necessarily want to step on the used toes. If they have huge problems with this, you know, we can talk about it.
Representative Hamilton, do you have a response?
Madam Chairman, thank you, and thank you, Representative Lesh. And you're absolutely right. We want to get this correct. And you do have my commitment to continue working with you on this as well. I would just like to have the university weigh in on this, if I could, please, Madam Chair.
All right.
And then I can respond.
And then also, and I know we're on this amendment, but if you've had a chance to look at the language offered by Mr. Ealing from NCOGI, if you have any opinions on that, maybe you don't yet, but it seems like that's pretty narrowly drafted too. So, Mr. Burr?
Yes, Chair Scott, thank you. I believe the proposed question from Representative Lesh would be to Ann. Thank you. I think that would be good. I think the maintain question is, as we're doing our research, often what we're doing is looking through time, and a lot of agriculture is what changes through time, particularly with things like climate adaptation, technologies coming in. We want to be able to maintain the data so that we can do that time series work with it. So I think that would be okay to make that change. The second question was in regard to the proposed language, and I haven't had time to review that, and I would want to certainly check with our general counsel to make sure, because the language around you know, what an individual means versus other terms is potentially a concern. But our concern is that what's happening is, as we narrow that down, is the data availability now, and I think it's a challenge. You know, we're all adapting to this idea of how much data is being collected on us day to day that allows someone to identify where you live, what your spending patterns are, those kinds of things. We're able to capture data now from numerous sources that, with machine learning, which is basically taking large algorithms to crunch the data, you can identify a lot about an individual farmer. And so it no longer becomes, their ability to opt in is getting less and less to say, yes, this data is private because it's my data. We have quite a bit of data that we can use to identify pollinator habitat in a particular location from satellite imagery and things like that. So we're very concerned about narrowing that. That ends up being an endless, the few items that are designated in the statute already would not encompass possibilities we have to be able to identify individuals. And when people recognize that, they become very concerned then about participating with their information, because it provides that ability to potentially be identified through other means. So we do have concerns about that piece. And again, I'll emphasize that the data, as we use it, once it gets aggregated into a form that is de-identifiable, that we are responsible to do under law as well, that it does become public at that point. So that's part of the university policy and other legislation as well.
Right.
And Madam Chair, and thank you, Dean. I appreciate that, you know, the fact that you know, these farmers can be identified and extrapolated through the use of metadata, because we're seeing that. You know, I mean, you go, I Google something online, and for the next 3 days, I'm getting Facebook ads on, do I want to buy a set of tires or something, right? When I'm just trying to figure out what the size of my tires are, okay? And that's not necessarily metadata, but that information then is sold, and they can figure stuff out about me that I don't even know about myself, which is irritating. But at the same – you quiet down, Rep. 15. Okay. But to a certain extent, I think we are very limited in our ability to combat against that, because technology is always moving faster than this body. And then second, as we do make that data non-public, we state government is absolutely liable for any leakage. And I'm sure you run a crack operation not allowing for leakage or data breaches, but you know, I am nervous about expanding our liability set in that context as well. But I absolutely get what you're saying.
Representative Hilstrom had a
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's not to this amendment. So as soon as the amendment stuff is done, then I want to talk about Section C in the bill.
Okay, very good.
Well, then, Madam Chair, I would ask for that oral amendment that on lines 1.4 that I change the or to an and.
Okay.
And I would offer the amendment. And I don't know if, you know, folks have comments on it. I'm completely open to conversation about it.
All right. Representative Pugh, I believe you have a question about the amendment.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. I just have a point of clarification to the author. I was taking a look at the The difference between the amendment and the bill is drafted, and I wanted to know what the significance, if there is a significant difference between the words informatics and data analysis. I mean, that's one of the very few changes, and I'm not really sure if that's significant at all.
Dean Burr.
Chair Scott, Representative Pugh. It's a minor change. It's a plain language change. As we call it, we use the term informatics, but it's really about data analysis, is what informatics is about.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Madam Chair.
So the A1 is before us, and on line 1.4, Representative Lesh is offering an oral amendment to change the or to an and. Further discussion on the amendment? Representative Hamilton? I'll let you weigh in and your testifier.
Madam Chair, just one clarification. Is it on 1.3 or 1.4, the oral amendment change?
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative, which or do you want to change? I thought it was maybe it is on 1.3.
Well, it is on 1.4 that
okay.
I had intended.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Because conjunctive versus disjunctive of the data sets we're classifying. So it's line 1.4, after maintained, change an or, the or to an and.
Okay,
Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, that would be fine.
Okay, and you're, okay.
Yes.
Okay, all those in favor of making that change to the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. That amendment is adopted. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now the full A1 amendment is before us. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton, I hope you'll continue to work with myself, Representative Lesh, and others, because we know what your intent is. We just want to make sure that the language reflects that. And so let's make that happen, because the motion is to put this to the general register, and I don't know where this is at in the Senate, if it's at a hearing yet or not, but maybe some work can be done there too. Oh, Representative Hilster, you had a question on another section of the bill.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Hamilton, I'm interested in, you know, you're adding the University of Minnesota to this existing statute, but in Section C, where the Department of Agriculture may disclose data, if there is a substantial threat to health, or human safety or to the environment, but you don't give the University of Minnesota the option to disclose to law enforcement if you actually find out that there's a problem. And I would think that if you came upon something that was a substantial threat to human health and safety or to the environment, that you would at least want to have the option of disclosing that to law enforcement if you so chose, because it's a may, not a must. I think you should think about whether or not, because otherwise if you find out something very dangerous, you would just have to hold it and not tell anyone.
Representative Hamilton.
I agree. Right? You're yes. Okay with that. Madam yeah. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's a great point. And I think that I don't know if you want to make a motion for amendment right now to add the University of Minnesota after the Department of Agriculture. I believe that would be a friendly amendment.
All right. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then on line 2.1, the Department of Agriculture or the University of Minnesota may, and then also line 2.2 after the Department of Agriculture or the University of Minnesota determines. So that would be my oral amendment.
Sure. Does House Research have that? Okay, perfect. Any questions on the amendment language? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment to House File 2982, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. So we did some cleanup here, Representative Hamilton. There's probably some more to do, and we appreciate you being here and your cooperation in making this bill the best it can be. All right. Thank you. Oh, we need to pass the bill.
Yes.
all those in favor of, I will renew my motion. Oh, Representative Howe renews his motion that House File 2982, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Your bill is on the way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
The next bill before us is House File 3259. That is my bill, and I would move that before the committee, and the motion is to send it to public safety. So the bill before us is an adjustment to the ALPR, the automatic automated license plate reader statutes, and the body cam auditing language. Now that we've begun to receive our first round of audits on the ALPR statutes, there was a lot of inconsistency in what we received as far as the audits, and current law says it has to be a summary, and we found that that just wasn't maybe the best language. And so you'll find in your packets an example of kind of the two extremes of audit summaries that we received. One is, I don't know how many pages long, let's see. Several pages. There's probably 10 pages to this one. This one's a two-pager. And we've had audit summary language that says, yes, we find that you're in full, that this agency is in full compliance. And that just wasn't, in my opinion, adequate information for the legislature to determine, you know, how this new policy is actually working. We studied this in the Data Practices Commission. Representative Lesh, Representative Lucero are on that commission. And we had recommendations that came out of that commission to change on the ALPR audit language. And I'll go through those in a second. I added the language on the body cam to this bill because I felt like we're trying to get some consistency in statute as far as language when we're dealing with these different forms of technology. And so that is why I addressed the body cam language at the same time. So the clarifying language, the things that the commission decided that we should look at and put in some clarifying language in a bill this session, were clarify that what constitutes an independent audit and prohibit law enforcement agency from auditing itself or being audited by another division of its political subdivision. So we had an instance where a city, I believe it was Minneapolis maybe, that Minneapolis was auditing Hennepin counties and vice versa. And we just didn't feel like there was as much enough space between those entities to really give us a level of comfort. So there's clarifying language in here. We're going to be tweaking that. I have met with law enforcement and also with IPAD about some of their concerns. And so we will be, you know, I will be amending this before the next committee. So one of the things that there was a question about is the legislative auditor had, or not the legislative auditor, the state auditor had done one of the audits. And so the language that we put in this bill, probably it could be construed as excluding the state auditor from doing those audits. And it was a fine audit, by the way. The next thing was to clarify applicable deadlines for completing the biennial audits. So right now in statute, the language says that once you've had the automated license plate readers in use for a certain amount of time, then you need to give us an audit. Well, that makes it a very staggered way of receiving these audits. So there's language in here that will kind of catch everybody up to the same date so that we'll be reporting all at the same time. The next provision was clarify what must be included in an audit report, include relevant information contained in the log of use required under subdivision 5. And so there's language in here addressing that, and some of those parts from our visit with law enforcement may or not be able to be included in the final bill. Just some of the data would have to be that is in this bill, 3259, would have to be collected manually and kept manually, and we just felt that was too onerous. So we'll be changing some of these sections. And again, on the word summarize that I mentioned before, we're changing that to an actual report rather than just a summary of the audit. We felt that, and then the report contains, we're asking in this statute or in this bill what the report should contain. In Subdivision 8, there's clarifying language when law enforcement agency must notify the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that it has begun using an ALPR. And so we had, there was some confusion over, do you report based on, do you contact the BCA when you acquire an ALPR or when you start using it? And so we're asking that they actually, that law enforcement actually does both, and then, but the clock will not start ticking until they actually start using the ALPR. So those are some of the changes that we're making to current statute. And I want to thank, I know Maren Bartels is here. She was our researcher that we were able to hire in the Data Practices Commission, and she was a great asset to our commission and really took all these ALPR audits as they were rolling in and tried to look through them and analyze what were the work products of the various agencies. And she also completed a report that summarized the entire activities of the Data Practices Commission. So if you're interested, that report is ready to go. And she worked with staff to draft language in today's bill. So I want to thank her. I want to thank law enforcement for visiting with me and for IPAD, too, because a lot of this, the audits were all going to them, too, and they were having to field questions about, well, what does this language mean in the new law? And so hopefully this bill will help clarify some areas, and as we continue to work with law enforcement and with IPAD moving forward, we hope to tighten it up even more so that the next round will be much smoother. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to get clarification based on what you said. You said it was your intention that the legislative or that the auditor couldn't audit them, because the language on line 2.27 says that they must contract with a private auditing firm.
Right.
So you're banning any public entity from doing these audits?
No. What we're doing there, and just to clarify, thank you for that question, to clarify. So that language we're going to tweak, because we want to allow the state auditor to be able to do these audits. What we don't want is Hennepin County auditing the city of Minneapolis, their police department's audits. That's what we, their ALP audits. That's what we're trying to get away from. We want a little more distance than that, but the state auditor is farther removed. Does that clarify what you're after?
Well, Madam Chair, is there going to be any money to provide for these audits? Because if you could have a public entity before do it, and the legislative auditor, or the state auditor, I believe, charges for these, you're now taking it from something that maybe you could do a reciprocal audit, right, and each side audit the other, to something that you absolutely have to pay for. So is there going to be any new money available for these audits, especially if you're now adding body camera audits, which I have to look specifically at the language of which new pieces are going to be added or not added. You know, otherwise, this is, again, another unfunded mandate without an ability for people to do it. And Madam Chair, what I don't want to have happen is, I mean, look, I'm for audits. But what I don't want to have happen is that the audits become so expensive and so cumbersome that then it stops the technology from being used because they say it's not worth doing the audits and using the technology.
And thanks for that question. You know, our analysis was that, and the Data Commission as well, that these need to be done in a very independent manner. And the law, both the ALPR and the body cam language, there's already audits required, so it was baked into the formula, baked into it when the bill was passed originally a couple of years ago. So, and I think law enforcement could probably testify as to, you know, what kind of funds they, you know, had to come up with to pay for the audits. And maybe there'll be down the road a time when the audits don't happen every 2 years. Maybe we lengthen the time between. But in the in-between time, I think it's really important as we're addressing new policy that, you know, the legislature is able to have some eyes on what's happening on the ground. Representative Lucero, did you have a question?
Thank you, ma'am. No, not a question, just a comment. To the unfunded mandate comment, I don't view this as an unfunded mandate. because there's no mandate that this technology be adopted. And so I view this as the responsibility, the accountability piece of that voluntary choice to adopt this technology. You have the privilege to do it, then you have the accountability. And so the privilege to use it is not a mandate, but if there's a voluntary choice to use it, there's the accountability piece.
Thank you. Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't disagree with that. The problem is once you've already adopted a statute and you decide you're going to use something based on the rules that we put in place and then you change the rules and now you say a government entity can't be the one, and this specifically in this language as written says a government entity can't do it. I know you're going to change that, but right now as written it says a government entity can't do it. And so we just have to be careful when we're making these we're asking folks to do certain behaviors, right? We pass a statute. They make decisions based on what we put in law. And then we have to make sure that we don't rip the rug out from underneath them. We get the accountability that we're looking for without making it an undue burden that they can't afford to do. So, look, I believe that there should be certain standards in every audit. We had the legislative auditor just do an audit of audits that were done not by government entities and did an analysis on whether their audits were up to the standards that they should be. So then are we going to put in place an audit of the auditors to make sure that these private auditors and entities that are doing these audits are doing them according to our standards, right? I mean, because we do that in other places too. So the question is, you know, how much and when do you make those changes? And usually I don't like to change contracts in the middle, you know, of an agreement. That's all.
Thank you. Are there other member questions? Or what I thought we'd do is hear from the testifiers. I know law enforcement is here. iPad is here. We will move on to those folks. The first testifier I have on the list is Mr. Ealing from Minkoji, and then Mr. Feist, and then the League of Minnesota Cities, and Chief Geiske, so kind of in that order. Welcome to back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I'll make my comments brief, and I'd be happy to take questions and follow up. We are supportive of the aims of this legislation. The aims were endorsed by a unanimous bipartisan group of members on the Legislative Data Practices Commission. The reason we have an interest in this, and I'm going to speak specifically to the ALPR piece, is that we have followed this issue since it came to the legislature several years ago, and it's a consequential issue because this is the first time that Minnesota law has regulated a mass surveillance program. And let's not make any mistakes that that's what this is. This gathers data on a suspicionless basis of anybody driving by an ALPR camera. Whether you're a lawbreaker or not, that goes into a government database. And knowing how that information is used is really critical to the regulatory framework that was set out. That's why there are audits. That's why there's so much public information about how the information is used. So to the degree that the audit language and the oversight language can be tightened, we support that. We would agree with the idea that having government entities that are closely aligned, such as Hennepin County and the City of Minneapolis, auditing each other is not a great way to ensure audit independence, so putting more distance there, however that comes out, is a good outcome. Likewise, in the log of use, which is one of the key features of the ALPR language passed in 2015 that sets out a very specific list of data that is public, so the public knows how this stuff is being utilized, I was able to look at some of the logs of use provided by law enforcement agencies. There was data missing that was required by law in certain instances. And in every instance that I saw, I'm not saying all, I didn't see all of them, so I'm not sure if there are other agencies included it. But in everything that I looked at, there was not a reference to the state or federal databases that were being cross-referenced as part of this program. And just historically, we know that the federal government is very interested in getting ALPR data. A few years ago, federal agencies had been trying to get ALPR data from states about people who had attended gun shows. More recently, ICE is trying to get ALPR data for its own purposes. So it's important to know how the federal government is interacting with state databases and state law enforcement agencies. And that would be required. It's not only required in current law to be in the log of use. but it would be part of the audit, the log of use provider under the audit under this new language. So I'm happy to take questions at the end, but we support this this change. Thank you.
Questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Seeing none, Mr. Feist. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just ask one question. Yep. So then do you believe that if we're going to require private entities to do the auditing, that we should have standards for auditing the private entities that are doing the audits to confirm they're complying with auditing standards?
Mr. Ealing.
Yeah. Representative Hillstrom, I think that the specificity of the list that's in this bill is essentially the check. One of the reasons why this bill, I think, is important to bring forward is that if you look at the audits that were provided by the private entities, and by and large all of the audits that I saw were by private entities under the last round of biennial audits, there's a lot of information missing in some of those. So the fact that you have a very specific list in the statute is really the check, and you can tell if it's been provided or not.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Feist. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak on this bill today. We very much support the idea of strengthening the audit provisions for ALPR and body cams under our current law. As many members of this committee are well aware, these were controversial technologies that were debated heavily over several years, and a big part of the compromise to allowing law enforcement to use these surveillance technologies was making sure that we have something in law that will provide transparency and accountability measures so that the legislature and ultimately the public can take a look at how these are being used and if there are other civil liberties violations and other things like that that might be happening. So I think I would lend my voice as well that some of the initial audits seemed a little bit lacking, and therefore any measures that we can get into law that will provide a little bit better, more standard language would be very much appreciated. Without getting into the old battles over the main policy here, I think it is really important to remember in terms of ALPR that we are taking the non-hit data on innocent people and holding it just in case you do something wrong in the future. And that is a difficult principle to deal with. Obviously, we had a compromise on the amount of retention time. But we should be reviewing that and making sure that law enforcement is using this appropriately going forward. Similarly, with the body cam bill, we at the ACLU were disappointed that it lacked a certain amount of transparency and accountability there. So, again, since most of that data is not going to be public and it's going to be hard to keep track of how this is being used, we think that strong audits are very important for that. So, again, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, for being here today.
Thank you.
Ms. Gal from League of Minnesota Cities, and then Chief Geisecke and Brian Mueller. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair members. My name is Irene Gow. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I do want to thank Chair Scott for her bill and talking about some of these issues with law enforcement. And I know some of the things I've mentioned to you before. And thank you for your initial comments in terms of areas where you saw that could use some work. And actually, I had three areas of concern. Two of them you've already addressed. So I will go through them quickly. The first was around the state auditor. I appreciate Representative Hillstrom's concern about cost. Initially, when we were working with the state auditor's office, it was because body camera audits came in at a pretty high estimate. And so we were really concerned about that. And so we tried to build that relationship. We'd be happy to work with language as well in terms of how to make sure that that option is still viable. The second concern is around how long to hold the ALPR data for. You had mentioned around the use of log of use and how that might work with the two-year audit. How do you handle that when the 60 days and some of the non-hit data needs to go away? We'll work on that as well. But the third thing is something that hasn't been addressed, and it falls under the body camera data. Generally, as you all know, there's a general standard for government data to be public. When it's not public, it can only be accessed by the data subject or by government employees or officials with a business reason need to know. The body camera law has a higher standard requiring written authorization by the head of a law enforcement agency in order to access it. And that does, under current law, need to be for a legitimate specified law enforcement purpose. In Section 4, what it does is that then changed the standard to reasonable suspicion, which is a legal standard of proof. One of the concerns about this is we want to make sure that when people are using body cameras, that they're using them correctly. It's important to cities and law enforcement agencies as well. If we want to go in and check and make sure that our patrol officers have been using them correctly, a supervising officer needs to have the ability to go in. Reasonable suspicion is not going to meet. You can't meet that standard for that purpose, and so we'd be happy to talk about that more as well. Like I said, I'd be happy to work with Chair Scott and others as we move forward with this bill, and I know there'll be some amendments in the future.
Right, and I appreciate that. I was aware of that issue from having talked to law enforcement, and I think it was just I had directed staff to just line the two up,
right.
And what works for one technology in this specific area doesn't work for the other one, so yeah. We'll be making that change. But thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Chief Geisicke. Welcome back to the committee.
Well, thank you.
You know the drill.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to be here, Madam Chair, members. I'm Burnsville Police Chief Eric Geisicke. I'm here today on behalf of my police department and also representing the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association. So I did want to get on the record that the bill, as it currently stands, we do oppose the bill. We do have significant concerns. I wanted to get that on the record. With that being said, we're deeply committed to working with Representative Scott, Madam Chair, on getting the language in the bill to a point we can all agree on. If you'll give me just a few minutes, I can highlight some of the concerns I have. I don't want to be redundant. Some of them have already been addressed, but specifically in the bill as it relates to lines 4.20 to 4.23, the concern is, you just heard it stated, limiting the ability to view the body camera for just active criminal investigation could potentially have some, I would say, serious unintended consequences. As you know, when we deployed body cameras, one of the driving forces behind it was to make sure we had police accountability and oversight, and so that we had a way to do that with our officers. Not everything an officer does is involved with their active criminal investigation, so it could potentially limit our ability or agency's ability to actually police their own officers. A lot of agencies have policies that they allow random audits of the body camera footage, and so this potentially could limit that, and I don't think that's something we want to do. So hopefully we can take a look at that, but I bring that forward to you in good faith. It's also important to note that a lot of what we do is not criminal in nature. Specific examples, there are times when officers have to go hands-on with individuals. It may not be a criminal investigation, but we don't. With this language, it could potentially restrict our ability to review our officers' use of force in some situations. So I just wanted to get that on the record as well. Continuing on, specifically lines 4.24 to 4.30, the language there, we would prefer to have the ability for some chief law enforcement executive officers to have the ability to assign access to the data. When Burnsville started using the body cameras in 2010, there was really only one system. There's a variety of systems right now, and some of the smaller agencies might not have as robust system in place to do that on the back end. So we just want to have the option to discuss that and be open to it. So some smaller agencies potentially with this language might be discouraged in actually using the cameras. You've heard about it, the body camera audits. We support the audits. We think they're important. We want to show that we're using the technology and the tools correctly. I'm a big proponent of audits. We've done our own internal audits. We've started generating our own reports that we provide to our city council. And I've heard Representative Scott, Madam Chair, you noted that the state auditor's office would be an option for us. We're excited for that. We've had conversations with them about that, and they've agreed to do our body camera audits this fall. So we'd like to keep that option open. As it relates to cost, one of the concerns that we have with private firms, I don't want to see police agencies, and I certainly don't want to see the taxpayers get overcharged or, for lack of a better term, milk down the process because nobody understands it. Some of the cost and the potential cost I've seen, I think, are outrageous, quite frankly. I know from our own experience, we can produce the information I think is needed and required by statute to show We are doing what we're supposed to do, but I'd hate to see agencies discouraged from doing it because someone's coming in trying to make money when I don't think it's, quite frankly, necessary to charge some of the amounts that I've seen. Not opposed to some costs, but we want the cost to be reasonable. So thanks for your openness to discuss other options with the auditing beyond just the private firms. The last point is lines 5.24 to 5.34 as it relates to local government oversight. Again, if this is transferred to the Department of Administration, during the initial discussions we had with body cameras, we do think it's important to have some local control. We know communities want to be involved with their agencies. We've heard from agencies, so we don't want to eliminate that. And if there's an issue in a community, we want the community to be able to have a voice and be part of that, if that makes sense. So those are the four main points. Again, like I said, we're deeply committed to working with Madam Chair, Representative Scott, to get this bill to a point we can all agree on the language. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Great. Any questions? Members, we have 5 minutes left, and we have to get out of here because rules is coming in. And so we have some options here. We can come back after session. We could, I don't want to cut anybody's testimony off, but I've publicly committed to working on this with law enforcement and with IPAD. So I don't know what anybody's.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I mean, maybe if there is some work to be done on this, I doubt that it would get done between now and the end of session. Maybe we could just take this up first thing on Tuesday and get something done quickly if we find comity.
All right. I hate to lay anything over, but I think that's probably the best option because I'm guessing everybody doesn't want to come back after session, and I'll be nice to you all this time. No promises for next time. So with that, we'll lay the bill over. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to know, is there anybody that came a far distance that wanted to testify? If we could take their testimony before we go in.
I don't know if there is. There anybody from a long ways away that can't come back on Tuesday? All right, seeing none. We will lay the bill over, and this will be the first thing we take up Tuesday morning. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we are